Let's be honest. You're not going for a cookie for sustenance. You're going for a cookie for the beauty of indulgence, for like the spirit of just letting free and being like, I know maybe this cookie isn't the thing that's gonna round out my diet for the day, but it's what's gonna bring me joy. And remind me that life's too short to worry about how many cookies I ate today.
That's the introduction to one of the new episodes of Netflix's Chef's Table. The voice you heard is Christina Tosi, the founder of New York's Milk Bar, which is known for a delicacy called crack pie and several flavors of ice cream that taste like the last sip of milk at the bottom of a bowl of cereal. Every episode of Chef's Table opens something like that one. The featured chef telling you about their food, telling you about themselves, and pulling you in for another course. David Gelb, who directed Jiro Dreams of Sushi, the best food documentary ever made, is the creator of Chef's Table and a director and producer on the series. Well, David Gelb, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. These four episodes are really interesting. They're all about pastry. So I thought maybe to start, you could tell me a little bit about one particular dessert from each one of these chefs, and then we can kind of pick one and go from there.
Okay, sure. So let's see. Well, I guess just to start, we'll talk a little bit about Christina Tosi, who is certainly one of the most famous and well-known pastry chefs of the year, and you know is in the world, and is kind of not only is she a great pastry chef, but she's created this incredible business called the Milk Bar, and one of the a dessert that really caught my attention when they opened the Milk Bar on the Upper West Side near my mom's house. And I went there with my mom, and I had the crack pie, and I was just shocked by how delicious and addictive it was. Hence the name. And that was, we found out that was a essentially something that she had just made for a staff meal. That was kind of an accident, in that the pie hadn't totally settled or solidified. And so it had kind of a liquidy almost inside, but it was just the most incredible, delicious thing. And I love that it was an accident. So we started to kind of investigate more. And she is just amazing because she has all the technical skill of a top, you know, a world-class pastry chef, you know, having worked at WD-50 and then became the pastry chef for Momofuku. But her sensibilities are so accessible. And she really kind of cuts to the heart of why we love dessert and how it just makes you feel good to eat these delicious cookies and cakes. Her stuff has a really interesting kind of visual look to it because it kind of feels homemade. It almost feels like you could do it.
Yeah, it looks like the stuff you buy at the Whole Foods bakery.
Right. But it is so delicious. There's something just kind of utterly unpretentious about the presentation of her stuff. And we actually feature her her cake as our poster for the new season. And it's kind of this really kind of crazy looking layered cake. Just really, really cool, really transparent, and just feels like something that you would eat at like a kid's birthday party. Yet it is incredibly delicious and full of kind of depth. I just saw a billboard where the cake is stacked so high. Netflix made this billboard where the top two layers of the cake extend off the billboard.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which is pretty cool. And that's on Pico and in La Cienega in Los Angeles.
So the crack pie, it's kind of like a Southern style chess pie. Like a gooey buttermilk pie, sort of?
I would say so. I mean, it is, it's just got this kind of incredible kind of rich and kind of salty, sweet. I mean, it's got an oat cookie crust, but the inside, yeah, I mean, it's very kind of soft and just, it just tastes decadent. I mean, if you're not careful, you'll easily eat the whole thing.
And then Will Goldfarb, tell me about one of his.
Well, one of the things, I mean, that, and this is actually right at the top of the episode, we talk about a dessert called Red, which is really cool. You know, he's just inspired by colors and concepts. And, you know, Will is kind of exceptional because he does an absolutely impossible task, which is to try to make a 8-course dessert tasting menu, which to a lot of people seems impossible. And it kind of, he tried to do it in New York, but it blew up. And now he's in Bali and, you know, he's able to use all these incredible, you know, Balinese native ingredients. So he's got, you know, these spices, herbs, and fresh cocoa, and he is just, kind of found a new life in Bali, where, you know, he's able to execute his dream of doing this, you know, dessert restaurant where you're just eating a ton of different desserts. He also has like kind of fun things. He has one called like the ghost face Keller too, with liquid curds. Kind of interesting, kind of fun, playful things, kind of named after the, you know, Wu-Tang Clan rapper. He's got a beer focaccia. You know, he's got all kinds of interesting and kind of weird things.
And then Corrado Asenza from Sicily.
So Asenza has a small gelato shop, kind of a pastry shop in Sicily. And what he does, he makes the most extraordinary gelato using, you know, all natural kind of beautiful ingredients from the, you know, the orchards and farms in the area. And his whole goal in making gelato is to bring out the absolute most delicious, pure flavor of the ingredients themselves, rather than adding sugar or adding any kind of preserved flavoring. So he's out there finding fresh fruits and vegetables and then turning them into these incredibly exquisite gelatos. He's particularly well known for his almond granita, which is just this stunning kind of pure almond flavor. But there was a problem in Sicily where the almond farmers in Noto specifically were essentially being driven out of business because, the prices were so low for the almonds. They just felt like it wasn't worth it. And he saved the almond industry by bringing attention to it. And, you know, the Noto almond is sort of his signature. So his almond granita is known throughout Italy as being the example of what, you know, the delicious taste of almonds and granita is supposed to be.
And then the fourth episode, and the one you directed, is Jordi Rocha, who whispers very mysteriously in his opening.
Right. So Jordi, he's been known as one of the greatest pastry chefs in the world. You know, he was celebrated as best pastry chef in the world by the world's 50 best. But his story is really remarkable because, you know, he had two older brothers who are significantly older than him. You know, there's a 12-year age gap between him and Josep, who's the middle brother. And then Joan is 2 years older than Josep. And the two of them had a successful restaurant already. They'd already opened El Cellar Can Roca. And Jordi really didn't know what his role was. He didn't know how he could contribute. And so he kind of became this kind of party guy, you know, and he was going out, he would work in the restaurant, you know, first as a waiter, later in the kitchen, but they just couldn't figure out what to do with him. And they put him in the pastry section under Damian Alsop, who was a, you know, very kind of masterful pastry chef who had worked under Gordon Ramsay. And he trained Jordi, and Jordi kind of found his place and his talent and, became really the third, you know, the completing the triangle of the Rocha brothers and led to their getting their third Michelin star and all the international success that they've received. And I think that one of the most interesting kind of the breakthrough dessert of his is his journey to Havana, which is about if you look at it, it looks exactly like a cigar. It's a cigar with kind of this green granita again that's so I guess it's supposed to be sort of like representing the tobacco in a little bowl. And what he did was he was making ice cream. And when you're making ice cream, you're supposed to, you know, essentially wear a lab coat. I mean, you're not supposed to let any kind of outside smells or flavors or anything interfere, because the cream absorbs scent and flavor very easily. So what he decided to do was he was going to smoke a cigar while he's making the ice cream. And somehow the ice cream has got this incredible, and this sounds gross when you say it, but it has this incredibly delicious sweet tobacco flavor. And he filled a chocolate cylinder with this, and he just like, it's like you're eating the most delicious flavor of a cigar, which I know sounds bizarre. And I'm not a big cigar smoker, but I mean, this was really something else.
A lot of his desserts have these sort of architectural features, and they're they jump off the plate, and they're very designer interesting to look at.
Absolutely, you know, whether he has a dish that's inspired by sheep, and it has kind of a wool like cotton candy on it. He's got the Messi's goal, which is like a soccer field, which is supposed to represent a landmark goal by Lionel Messi. He's got a dessert that looks like you're eating the pages of a book. I mean, he's very conceptual. There's the breathing plate where they fabricated a plate that kind of moves up and down as you eat it, which makes it seem like what you're eating is alive, which is kind of strange. So he's a bit of a magician. And he loves the kind of theatrics of dessert.
Well, I want to start a little bit with the Christina Tosi episode. She's an American, and I would say one of the better known chefs across all of the seasons of the series you've done. When I'm going to be talking to a producer or a showrunner on one of these series, I watch the episodes and keep a Google Docs file and make notes about things I want to ask or things that seem interesting. And I realized as I got to the end of watching that episode, which is 45 or 50 minutes, I didn't have a single note. I never paused it once. And I think it was just, I just disappeared into it. I turned off my analytical brain of thinking about how to talk about the episode and just watched it. And it was kind of an unusual experience. Tell me how you get that. How do you edit an episode for that kind of pacing and that kind of checking your brain and just watching the thing happen?
Oh, well, thank you so much. You know, it really starts with the chef, and it starts with the casting. You know, we really try hard to find chefs whose stories will make a good movie. You know, we think about it, you know, when we're casting, we don't even think about them as documentaries. We think, you know, could you make a film about this? Even if you're going to make a narrative, like a scripted film, could you make a scripted film about this person? And, you know, that's more true of some episodes than others. For Christina Tosi, I mean, we felt like, you know, you could make a movie about her. I mean, we were so into like just where, you know, where she's coming from and kind of, you know, this small town, you know, learning to bake with her mom and her grandmother and then kind of creating this, you know, this empire and having these breakthroughs and also the internal obstacles that she faces, you know, in her own self-confidence, believing that her, you know, imperfect crack pie, you know, should be served. You know, she didn't want to, she was like, this is a mistake. And so, you know, she really had to learn to believe in herself. And that's just kind of a great theme for a character. It's really, in terms of the execution, it's such a team effort. And, you know, we are very lucky that we have these incredibly dedicated crew members who love working on the show and a lot of them have been with us since the first season. You know, this episode was directed by Andrew Freed, who, you know, helped us, you know, basically create the show in the first place. And, you know, we have dedicated story producers and editors. And, you know, essentially, we've just gotten kind of good at it by season five. So it's become easier. But essentially, we lay it out like, you know, it's the hero's journey. I mean, we lay out the story. We lay out the story of what we think we want to get. We go out and shoot it. Things are a little bit different. And then we come back and we just kind of work at it. And I don't know how else to say it, but just through gumption and trial and error, you know, we find a flow that really feels like a movie.
So what do you see when you start building the episode after you're finished with production? Do you see something like a 2 or 3 hour assembly that you're having to pick scenes and cut down? Or is it something more conceptual and you're going to find the scenes and more like taking a script and building it into the episode? Which direction do you start?
Sure. Well, you know, it really begins with the, you know, once we've cast our chefs, you know, we turn it over. We have our kind of summary that we brief the director. And, you know, this is why we chose this chef. This is the general gist of what we think the story is. And then we turn it over to that director and the story producer. And our lead story producer, Danny O'Malley, will weigh in and assign a kind of a dedicated story producer to that episode. And the story producer is kind of like a doc writer in a way. And what they'll do is they'll work with the director. They'll bring the director a ton of research. The director will kind of choose what they think is what could be the most interesting scenes, or what are the dishes that we want to focus on and tell stories about? What are the specific dishes that have biographical significance in their lives? You know, like for example, the crack pie is not only is it a very famous, you know, dish, but it's also a personal turning point for Christina. So we kind of try to figure out what those milestones are in advance. Then we work with the chef. We talk to the chef. We pitch them, you know, our shooting schedule. You know, they'll have some things that they will suggest to us that we may not know about that hasn't been written about, for example. With Christina, we have an advantage because, you know, there's been quite a bit written about her. So at that point, we go and we shoot it. As we're shooting, we're sending transcripts of the interviews back to the story producer, who is then, you know, making sure that we are checking off all the boxes and also exploring new leads that we're learning in the interview. Our interviews are so long, and we spend so much time with our chefs that we'll often uncover things that we just didn't know about that haven't been written about. You know, we discover new storylines as well. But then finally, you know, it's about 2 week shoot. We bring all the footage back, and the story producer spends about 2 weeks just digging in. You know, we'll confer with the director to kind of talk about what they thought was interesting about the episode, what's changed. And then they'll just start to kind of build a script for the episode using interviews with the chef and with the kind of experts that we have that kind of add context and color. And we kind of start to build a kind of skeletal structure of the episode, starting mostly with dialogue and then laying in visuals. And the first cut will probably come in. We try to bring it in at around an hour. And then things usually start to kind of whittle down. We start to figure out what's really hitting. Also, sometimes we'll find that we have multiple interesting ways of saying something that only really needs to be said once. So we kind of have to choose where we want our story points to hit. And then, you know, we watch it as a group. We bring in, you know, all the story producers and often bring in the other directors and stuff. Everybody watches it. We give feedback. And then and we repeat that process over and over again until we're all happy and we send it off.
The beginnings of these are really interesting. I remembered the one about Massimo Bottura and went back and watched it and watched the beginnings of some of the others. And you do something really interesting in these 1 or 2 minute bits. It's always the chef talking, but it's not always the same kind of thing. Sometimes he's telling a story. Sometimes you sort of get him in his own head doing something more philosophical, but it always gets to sort of something about what makes that particular chef tick. Do you know where those are when you see them in the footage? I mean, does it jump out at you as this is the intro?
Yeah, usually it's a situation where there'll be 1 or 2 moments that we'll find that'll be like, this is a hook. And often that'll be a hook that maybe doesn't fit elsewhere in the episode or doesn't necessarily flow, but it's something that we wanted to like kind of raise a question or to whet your appetite. It's the, I'll use one food pun, you know, it's like the amuse bouche, you know, it's like the, well, it's not a pun, but you know what I mean? It's the thing that, you know, we find it like, this makes me want to learn about this person. You know, so we try to find one little surprising detail or one little story. You know, in Massimo's case, he saved Parmigiano Reggiano, and we're like, that's a great story. And so to show that he's not just a chef who is trying to make delicious food, He's someone that is trying to, you know, send a message and is trying to, you know, basically move the conversation forward in a way. In this case, it was the cause of trying to save an industry that had been devastated by an earthquake. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the idea. It's like, what is that clue? And sometimes, you know, we'll find multiple ones. We'll have trouble deciding which one should be, you know, what we call the cold open. But it's always got to be something that just kind of piques your curiosity. I think that's the goal there.
For Jordy Rocha, for me, and there's a little bit of a mystery with some of these. With Jordy Rocha, it was, why is he whispering? And then you get into that a little bit in the episode about his voice being a little unusual. And then that becomes something that informs his personality, and that he's a listener and he's very judicious in what he says when he speaks, because he doesn't speak a lot.
Yeah. I mean, that was a debate that we had internally, was how long can we go without explaining why he's whispering? And, you know, originally the first cold open was an explanation of what happened to his voice. But then I just realized that that's not what the episode is about. You know, we try to give a hint of themes that we're going to be exploring later in the episode. And in his case, I mean, it's a very straightforward story about someone trying to find their place in their family and wanting to contribute, and but not knowing how. And I love how he kind of described it. So in this case, the whisper actually kind of adds to the mystery a little bit. And so we address it fairly quickly, I believe, in the first act of the episode, just so we get it. And then you learn about how that's affected the way that he communicates and all of that. But, you know, he's an incredibly thoughtful person. And when he was younger, you know, before this thing with his voice happened, you know, he was a fairly, you know, loud person. And you can see that he expresses himself now through his food. And if you go on his Instagram, he has all these crazy, amazing videos and stuff. And, you know, he's really a performer. And losing his voice hasn't stopped him from doing that.
I think with Christina Tosi, it was, how does she eat all these cookies and stay so skinny?
Well, you see the shots of her running.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was, I remember that from Dan Barber too. I think you had footage of Dan Barber running in his episode, and you're like, oh yes, now I get to feel guilty because I would like to eat these cookies too, but she's out there running the cookies off. The one shot I remember from that episode that I think made a particular emotional connection, and there's little shots like this all through the series, and I know you know them when you see them happen, but like her daughter is like standing on a stool or a chair or something in the kitchen and has got the rolling pin, and she's talking about family and growing up and you know, her mother telling her she didn't need an easy bake oven, she could use the, you know, she could use the real oven. And it's just like, this image is about her, you know, her family history, the culture of food and her family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, totally. And I think that's one of the things that really, you know, that gets me, you know, emotional. And that's what we, you know, we talk about, you know, we don't teach people how to cook on our show. It's really, we teach about why people cook. And in this case, you know, we imitate our parents, and, you know, when our parents take great joy in cooking, that's something that we do as well. My mom's is a chef, you know, she does, kind of technical recipe writing, for cookbooks. And so she was constantly testing, food in the kitchen. And that's why I became obsessed with food. And so I love seeing where Christina gets that, and also just kind of hinting, this is going to continue through generations. And that's why, you know, restaurants are often these kind of familial institutions.
I think one variable that you see, or a continuum that you see across all these episodes and across all these seasons, is what is their approach to the traditional food, I think somebody in one of the episodes calls it upscale grandma food, and the more avant-garde experimental parts of it. And I, just when you think you see somebody falling into one of those or the other, you know, you see Corrado Asenzo putting, I think it was oysters on a granita or something. And like, what the hell is he doing? And is that something you think about? I mean, is that tradition versus experimentation, or tradition versus change, something that you see all these chefs deal with?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think for all artists, I think that's something that you run into. You know, you want to create something new. It's like kind of the Icarus story. You know, you keep kind of flying higher and higher, trying new things until, you know, you're too close to the sun and the wings burn off. And then you just have to kind of start over and start from basics. And I think that's a journey that a lot of our chefs go through. You know, and that's just they're trying, you know, for Corrado's example. Yeah. I mean, he alienated his customers because it got a little weird. And I mean, I'm sure that those seafood combinations are daring and delicious, but it's hard to innovate in your own backyard, especially in Italy. I mean, you know, and if you look at, you know, that's kind of echoed in Massimo's story about how, you know, he was kind of became villainized by the local press because he was serving, you know, only 6 tortellini to a plate, or he was doing these kind of radical experimental things that he's walked back a bit. So, yeah, I mean, I think that that's just part of the creative process. You know, I think that, you know, we push it to a point and then we realize that it's completely blown up and it's too wacky, and then we walk it back.
I mean, do you see from your vantage point producing the series and, you know, after all these episodes that you've done, that one of those is winning out over the other, or that both models are these really vital things that we need a lot of both? I mean, do you have come to any opinions about that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that the episodes that really get people, it's really all about the characters. You know, if you look at Francis Mallmann, for example, which I think is by far one of our most popular episodes, you know, he's making really delicious Argentinian food, often, you know, with kind of French influence or kind of worldly technique that he's bringing back to, you know, his kind of Patagonian cuisine. But, you know, his episode is really not about, you know, his experimenting with food. It's about his, you know, about his life and how he chooses to live and his philosophy. So I think that's the kind of story that I think plays really strongly. And the food is also an expression of the character. So I think in some cases, you know, the character is wild eyed and searching for, you know, something that nobody has ever done before. You know, people like, you know, like Massimo, for example, constantly pushing the boundaries. But then you also have someone like Nancy Silverton in our most season 3, who, you know, she wants to capture the delicious flavors of her memory and her travels in Italy and then produce them, you know, with her own twist to them. But it's really just trying to get to the core of what she loved about them in the first place. So it's a bit more kind of humble in that way, if you want to use that word. So, you know, I think that all different types of characters kind of either pushing the envelope entirely or infusing something a bit more subtle and emotional into their food. You know, so we kind of try to get a whole spectrum.
How are chefs coming to your attention for the most part? Are you keep a list of people you think are interesting, or you're eating at a lot of restaurants, or what's the path to getting to your show?
You know, all different ways. I mean, we talk to a lot of chefs. You know, chefs have strong opinions about, you know, who they think is cool or interesting. So a lot of the chefs that we choose that are less famous, kind of off the beaten path, come from recommendations from chefs that we've worked with or that we know. Also, the experts that we use in our episodes help guide us to places that are a little less expected. We also read a lot. You know, we're constantly reading, you know, newspapers and magazines, you know, web magazines and things like that, trying to find great stories, you know, things that we would want to adapt into a film. And that's kind of how we get started. Like, for example, the day that there was a New York Times article by Jeff Gordonier about Jung Kwan, the Korean Buddhist nun, who was making this extraordinary food that, you know, chefs like Eric Repair and Renee Redzepi were saying was just extraordinary and visionary. And she's making all this stuff. She doesn't have a restaurant in the mountain, you know, she's in the mountains outside of Seoul. And I immediately read the article and was like, wow, this is a film right here. So sometimes it's presented right in front of us. And sometimes, you know, we're searching. We always want to have a spectrum of some chefs that are, you know, quite famous, like Massimo, for example, like Christina. Jordi is pretty famous. But then Corrado and is quite unknown, actually, outside of Italy. And, you know, Will Goldfarb was kind of, you know, was again, you know, kind of like, you know, he's out in Bali and there's not a whole lot of stuff being written about him right now. So, you know, we're just trying to find a spectrum of like different levels of fame. So there's a feeling of discovery. And then when it comes to the more famous chefs that have been written about, we're trying to go deeper or look at it from a different angle or look at it from a more personal perspective. So like in the case of Grant Achatz, who's been written about quite a bit, we're trying to make, you know, the most detailed kind of emotional film version of that story. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that you'll see in our episodes, you nobody will have known about before. And again, that's part of the byproduct of shooting these very long interviews, because over time during the interview, they run out of things that they want to say, and they really just, it becomes a therapy session. And I think that's one of the most exciting things about the show is, you know, it's going deep and taking these chefs who have done a lot of work before and then being able to go even deeper and discover new things about the work that other people or they themselves may not have even realized.
Are you getting restless to approach like artists or social activists or political figures or some other kind of person, or are there still plenty of chefs and you still have plenty of energy for doing this particular series?
Mm. I mean, we love making Chef's Table. We just love it. You know, it's a real, I mean, I consider myself to be one of the luckiest people in the world to be able to work on this show where, you know, we can essentially travel the world, eat the best food and hang out with really inspiring and interesting people.
Awesome when you say it that way.
Yeah. And our crew has really become a family, you know, our both our post crew and our production crew, many of them have been with us since the beginning. And so it's quite a bit of fun, and we'd love to keep going because, you know, as I said, we're not teaching people how to make things, we're teaching about why they do it. And so there are always more and more inspiring stories. And also we want to branch out to, you know, more kind of, you know, I guess diverse types of restaurants. You know, if you look at the beginning of the series, we were very focused on super high-end, you know, tasting course, Michelin-starred kind of restaurants. But we're kind of breaking away from that and trying to broaden our scope. I think we're excited about that. And I think you'll see more of that in future seasons. Lots of different types of stories from different parts of the world, smaller restaurants, some places that may not even be considered fine dining at all. And so that's exciting. But we're also, you know, we're interested in looking at telling stories about other types of people and other professions, but as different shows. I think Chef's Table will remain about chefs.
I made a list of commonalities that I've seen in chefs across the series, and I'm curious what your take on some of these would be, or whether you see other things than what I've seen. The first thing is a high tolerance for risk.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what makes them exciting characters and what makes their stories dramatic is putting it all on the line. So yeah, that's pretty common.
And then one thing that's related to that, but motivated a little differently, is intellectual curiosity, which I mm-hmm. definitely see this season.
Yeah.
Patience with failure.
Yeah. I would say both patience and impatience alternately.
A sense that they're doing what seems to make sense for themselves rather than trying to be famous or trying to do something new for the sake of doing something new. They seem very centered.
Mm-hmm.
And then a little bit of a sense that there's another level or another thing that they can get to if they keep hacking at it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, totally. And I mean, that's something that, you know, if you go back to Jiro Dreams of Sushi, which is sort of the, you know, feature film kind of pilot almost, you know, I didn't realize that I was going to be making a series called Chef's Table when I was making Jiro Dreams of Sushi. But that's the thing that got me most fascinated probably in Jiro was this idea. He's 85 years old. He is the first 3-star Michelin sushi chef in the world. You know, he's unanimously considered to be like the legend, you know, the godfather of sushi, of modern sushi. And he's sitting there saying that he's just getting the hang of it. And, you know, the more that you know, and the more that you learn, the more that you realize how much you don't know. And I think that is such an inspiring quality. So none of our chefs believe that they have reached any kind of apex. And I think that that's really fascinating. They all want to learn. But that's the kind of humility that is necessary to be great. And I think you'll find that in a number of these stories, the chefs may have felt like at some point that they have made it, only to realize that that was like a false victory, and that the real kind of the real work is still ahead of them.
Which happened and, to Will Goldfarb.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. So those stories about, you know, you think you've made it and then you crash and burn and then you have to put the pieces back together and you come back in a with that humility, it allows you to do better work. And I think that kind of curiosity, that feeling that there's always another level to reach, is an essential trait for our show.
The Corrado Essenza episode reminded me of Jiro Dreams of Sushi, and mostly because of the end where he's talking about, you know, the son turning down another job to stay, you know, with him, and how, I mean, I can't think of another episode of the series that reminded me of Jiro as much as that one.
Sure. I mean, in so many ways. It also just the idea that, you know, you look at ice cream or, you know, gelato, you look at, you know, sorbet, granita, and think, okay, well, great. You know, it's sugar and it's milk or and it's eggs or, you know, whatever it is. There is so much that can be put into so much kind of practice and subtlety that can be put into make it exceptional and to make it shine. And it's the same, you know, with sushi. You know, when I was first making Jiro Dreams of Sushi, people were like, oh, it's just fish and rice. You know, how are you going to make a feature film about that? And, you know, there's so much more to it. And I feel like kind of revealing those layers behind the scenes makes you look at gelato in a new way, in the way that Jiro makes you look at sushi in a new way. And it's kind of the hope that we have.
Well, David Gelb, I really appreciate you talking to me. I love the series. I'm glad to hear that you've got other seasons in the planning stages.
Oh, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it.